Hello, everyone, and welcome to ESIB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and I am very pleased to say that today I am joined by Alex Kupri to talk about his new book titled Techno-Nationalism, How It Is Reshaping Trade, Geopolitics, and Society. It's a great book that I recommend to everyone with an interest in the subject. And Alex now teaches business and public policy at the National University of Singapore. But for a long time, he also built practical experience of the world of trade and techno-nationalism. He was with the KPMG's global trade practice for several years and was a partner and regional leader for the company's international trade and customs practice in Asia. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Frederick.
So, techno-nationalism. I think many listeners will have at least a broad idea what it is, and I assume that many of them are going to have followed debates over, say, US export restrictions to China in certain technologies, and perhaps how the whole area of semiconductors have increasingly become charged, not just with restrictions, but efforts to localize production. But I think it could be useful for us to take a step back and first ask, what is techno-nationalism?
Yes, and as most people would probably assume, it's about nation states linking technological prowess directly to national security, increasingly now to economic security and strength, and from a social aspect, because of hybrid warfare all around us, there are issues around truth, disinformation, narrative wars, etc., and all of those are also dependent on technological prowess. So those things form the basis of what a simple definition of techno-nationalism is.
Mm. And if we then start to think a little bit about type of measures that easily are folded into this category or this world of techno-nationalism, would it be anything specific that you would like to point us to?
Yeah. So what I have done is I've looked at techno-nationalism historically and also present day through a framework of six core elements. And those elements really are quite interlinked. And again, your listeners would recognize most of these. Maybe they would recognize the behaviors and not necessarily the definition. But the first category is what I refer to as supply chain or value chain weaponization. And that means nation states actively looking to prevent others, both corporate entities and indirectly national entities, from acquiring strategic technologies. And to do that, we've seen a combination of export controls, sanctions. We've seen increasing controls on outbound direct investments, acquisitions, those types of things. So that weaponization of value chains applies to physical goods, the flows of data, and now increasingly to human capital. So talent, actual people, individuals with specific passports, for example. So that first phenomenon has led to a second element, which is decoupling. Or I think it's very important to insert the word strategic, right? So the decoupling of very strategic industries and supply chains around specific types of technologies, which I'll come back to. So there's strategic decoupling and de-risking. De-risking would be more of sort of a garden variety de-risking that you would see in supply chains anytime, right? Things like diversification, removing bottlenecks, et cetera. The next element is reshoring, nearshoring, ring fencing. And again, moving supply chains closer to home or back home, or looking to create so-called resilient supply chains through more trusted, reliable nation states and entities. The fourth element is what some have called innovation mercantilism, which is really another way of saying very aggressive industrial policy that focuses very, very closely on technology. The next element, which I'd love to talk a little bit more about during this podcast, particularly given the character who occupies the White House right now, and that is tech diplomacy, right? So that is the combination of G to G, G to B, public-private partnerships, but very, very proactive governments looking to build strategic partnerships around these other elements of techno-nationalism, right? Looking for alliances, looking for support, and so on. And the final sixth element, and I know I've gone on quite a while, so I'll stop after this. But the sixth element is really more of an existential thing, and that is sort of this ever-present state of hybrid Cold War that we're in. Mm. So those would be the definition plus the six elements.
Yeah, and I mean, as you said, also, Alex, I mean, you're taking a historical view on it as well. So if we take the pulse on these developments right now, I mean, would you say how fast are we accelerating in that space of techno-nationalism today? I mean, we can all read the news and we hear about measures being taken in Europe, America, China, and elsewhere. Are we on the cusp of sort of a major acceleration in techno-nationalism right now?
That's a great question. So historically, I refer to in the book to the technology feedback loop, right? And that's sort of this virtuous cycle, if you will, that produces a kind of power network effect that involves, you know, technology as an accelerator and technology as an enabler, but how that technology is then innovated, developed, grown by the defense establishment, by academic institutions, obviously specific government institutions, and then of course private companies and the private sector. All of those working together, producing this kind of network effect. So that's always existed. What's happened today, Frederick, as you know, is technology as a whole is scaling up innovation at an unprecedented rate, and it's becoming ubiquitous. In other words, it's pervading. Technology is pervading all elements of life: economic, social, political, obviously defense related. So today's version of techno-nationalism is far more ubiquitous and with much more severe consequences for losers, because we are at this major inflection point around AI, semiconductors. Mm. Now, there are 12 strategic technologies that I have focused on in the book. And as one could imagine, the foundational sort of ground zero technology, pretty much for all others, is in fact semiconductors, right? So semiconductors are essential to any of the other technologies, and those would include things like aerospace, artificial intelligence, biotech, hypersonic, things like timing sensing equipment, obviously quantum energy, advanced energy, you know, those types of things. But really at the heart of all of those are semiconductors, and what I refer to often in the book as the semiconductor AI nexus, right? And why that is so critical.
Mm. So, I mean, still taking more of a historical view and trying to understand where we are. So are there any important differences between previous tech accelerations that we've seen and where we are today? I mean, just to think on the top of my head, if I was going to say, well, looking at this from Belgium, 300-400 years ago, you're going to find a Dutch government that wanted to prevent Belgium to get access to certain technologies. And 50 years ago, it may have been a little bit less aggressive, but still they wanted to have a leg up compared to next door neighbors. Today, that doesn't seem to be the case, at least not in Europe. This sort of seems to be much more about geopolitical frameworks that are being forming around technologies, where you have more dependence, more collaborations, more partnership in some groups, but then you put sort of walls up mm-hmm. against others. Is that yeah. right?
Yeah, I think a few things are different today along those lines. One is, and this is a theme that's pervasive throughout the book, and that is that we are facing paradox in so many ways, right? Because as you say, the modern global economy is very interdependent, it's very connected, and relationships, trading relationships, supply chains, et cetera, have been established between what are now solid rivals, right? China, the United States, et cetera. So I think what is different today is also the fact that when you look at the partnerships, the public-private partnerships that have developed, they're very, very international, right? Mm. And that's happened really on a scale never before seen. But nonetheless, the rivalry, the strategic importance of those 12 technologies from a self-sufficiency standpoint have never been greater, right? So, you know, I think, you know, you mentioned the Dutch and the Belgians. You know, the Dutch East India Company, if you go back, you know, that was really the first great example of a techno-nationalist arrangement, right? Development, which really set up the West versus the rest scenario when it came to economic and technological advancement. I think if we go back 100 years, let's just go back to the First World War. You know, that was the war of chemists, the war of engineers. The technologies that came out of that war were prolific, right? There were so many. And then, you know, in the book, what I do is I trace techno-nationalism really through the 20th century and look at obviously the Second World War, obviously the Cold War, the space race, the moonshot, the nuclear arms race, you know, through the end of the Third Industrial Revolution. And of course, now we are in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And I think what's another key difference to your question, Frederick, is I think with the expansion of AI, with the phenomenon of open source, there will be many more players that will acquire very powerful technology with lower barriers to entry, even as in very selected strategic industries like semiconductors and like the high end of AI and you know other things like hypersonics and quantum and so forth, those will remain very high barrier entry areas, and you will see those six elements of techno-nationalism playing out. But within an open source environment, particularly as AI becomes more and more powerful, I think what we will see in a techno-nationalist environment is more and more fragmentation of the trade landscape, more and more fragmentation of financial markets, more and more fragmentation and ring fencing around corporate empires, if you will, big corporate interests. And that's where I get into another theme in the book, and is what I call the gray area, right? The state firm gray area. And happy to talk more about that.
Oh, it's a very interesting part, and not just state firms either. I mean, if you look at different countries or different technologies, you can easily find that they can easily point to certain companies that have an outsized importance for the entire technological ecology of that country, and of course these companies being of strong importance for how they're going to access technology and compete in the world in the future as well. Take sort of the big tech companies in America. It's very difficult to think about U.S. Techno-nationalism or techno-dominance or supremacy, whatever type of language you want to use, without having access to these companies.
Absolutely. And, you know, you go back to the Second World War, companies like Daimler, Bosch, yeah, and others, there's almost invariably a beneficial spillover effect commercially to techno-nationalist efforts, right? So again, the American companies that were involved, again, in the space race, obviously in the Second World War, the Cold War, they received a lot of funding. They were given a lot of sort of blue sky, sort of, you know, long-term horizon type of project developments that would never have occurred in a full free market, right? That just never would have happened. And yet those companies, you know, they've been able to turn that into sort of commercial operations for every, you know, General Motors, for example, obviously Boeing. And then, as you mentioned, the big tech companies, you know, you think of Amazon Web Services, you think of obviously Microsoft, when you look at things like the cloud and AI and data centers and those types of things, they are receiving massive amounts of funding and you know, multi-billion dollar contracts that they're engaged in with the US government. And they've developed this sort of symbiotic kind of relationship with the US government as the US government looks at companies like Starlink, SpaceX, for example. You know, those are very strategic assets in a techno-nationalist global competition. And, you know, we've had...
I suppose also because they are much more capable in terms of delivering the technologies and innovations you need. I mean, if you compare Elon Musk and SpaceX and Starlink and they compare with NASA, I mean, Musk is much more capable in delivering actual techno results for the US government, right?
Absolutely. And this brings in another sort of core theme of the book, and that is the role of the private sector in techno-nationalist competition. So we have this gray area, this very murky area where you have tech startups, you have the big established corporations that are innovating. They are building very, very competitive, very leading edge technology for everything from the mining of asteroids, literally in space, to building establishments on the moon and getting us to Mars, to obviously military applications. And so you have this web, you have this very murky web of private entities profiting, companies like Palantir, right, building the AI and the software, and you know, many of the big tech companies that we've mentioned, right, they're directly involved in the US, in the States. So that symbiotic relationship, on the one hand, can be very beneficial. It can also be market distorting. And it can also create problems for corporate entities as they're targeted by other governments, right? Seen as proxies.
Of course.
Yeah. So that's really the name of the game. It's a very messy, complex, overlapping kind of thing.
And how should we think about the emerging sort of networks of production and competition as now companies start to compete much more here? So one model is going to be that you say, all right, we need to localize and nationalize everything from sort of the smallest components that goes into whatever we're supposed to build. Another way could be, we just need to look at the upstream technology, basically that we are going to own the technology, the patents, that we are making more investments. So at least we're going to be 6 months, a year, 18 months ahead of any other competitor. I mean, even a country like the United States just can't localize everything to America. They need to sort of work in partnerships with others. So I suppose the type of patents that are emerging in this type of competition is much more an upstream technology than sort of downstream supply chains.
Well, let's refer to that. It's a great question. Let's refer to that as the technology stack in general. So the technology stack, you can pick any one of those strategic industries. The technology stack means at the very, very top end, we're looking at rare earths and critical minerals and actual, you know, components and base materials. As you work your way down, you're seeing everything that would happen, say, for example, in a data center, right? To produce a leading edge data center that's connected to the cloud, has compute power, is utilizing AI. So that's a very vertical stack, if you will. So You know, in a perfect free market world, you know, under the trade liberalization model, you know, that supply chain or that value chain would migrate wherever it needed to go, and it would fully rationalize to the most cost-effective, the most efficient allocation of resources, et cetera, and the most profit beneficial. Now, when we look at this from a geoeconomic standpoint, now we have to introduce the externalities that I've just mentioned, right? So now you have countries saying, all right, we need to have either self-reliance or we need to have much more resilient, much more secure value chains around these very, very core strategic industries and sectors. How do we do that? If we're talking about something like semiconductors, many of the other, 12 strategic technologies, it would be very difficult for any one country to be able to ring fence that whole supply chain. So this is why I mentioned the tech diplomacy element at the top of the podcast, and why I can't use the word surprised, but I am still, let's just say, I'm just blown away by the fact that the Trump administration is just not making efforts to produce sort of strategic alliances around those very core strategic sectors, like the Biden administration did with semiconductors, for example, with critical minerals and rare earths, and so on. Having said that, the rhetoric may not be matching the reality, because we are actually seeing critical minerals, rare earths, magnets, those very, very essential elements at the top of the technology stack for virtually all the other technologies. We are beginning to see what is going to be a 5 to 10 year effort of seeing those value chains completely restructure and completely reorganize. That's happening. And it's happening not purely from a government perspective, but it's happening through things like the CHIPS Act in the US that is combining government initiative with private investment. So I think if we were to step back and say, you know, is there any one clean, efficient model that's going to explain, you know, how governments, nations are going to make this transition? The answer is no, but it is going to be a combination of the market, government money, public money, and there's going to have to be a sweet spot, you know, in there. Again, I want to emphasize the 12 strategic areas, right? There's going to be a sweet spot for both profit, markets, and then techno-nationalism. So I do think we'll see that play out. And again, we've discussed this once before over lunch, of course, but I don't see the world in a dramatic deglobalization process. What I see this as a reorganization process and a bifurcation of those key strategic supply chains around China, Russia, et cetera, and sort of the G7++. Notwithstanding transatlantic relations right now, I think those will remain. That relationship will remain strong in the long term, in the mid to long term. So I do think we will see tech diplomacy playing a fairly significant role, even as Europe looks to sort of decouple, if you will, from the U.S. from a defense perspective, and look to build its own sort of technology stack.
And I suppose in this emerging, reorganizing, but sort of still globalized world economy, I suppose there are some countries that are going to find that, well, we didn't really find that sweet spot. It's actually that all these structural changes happening right now are putting us in a very, very awkward position. And in the first place, you could say, well, small and mid-sized economies, well, they may not fare that well, because at the end of the day, if technology, ownership of knowledge, patents, if all that is important, well, it's just a mathematical observation that small countries are not going to be able to be around that much in all these technologies. They will be much more dependent on the larger economies which have the capacity to supply them and to invite them to be part of of a new form of reorganized supply chain. And then I suppose, I mean, let's say you're sitting somewhere in Southeast Asia, you're not going to be all that happy with this development because on the one hand, you have a big neighbor, which is important to you, and then you have a big customer, which is important to you as well, which it's sort of on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. So how do you think sort of winners and losers or, you know, structural changes, how they're going to impact on different type of countries?
Yeah, they're for smaller countries in the global south, you mentioned Southeast Asian countries, even India, you know, when we talk about a binary choice, having to choose sides, that is, of course, something no country wants to do, right? That is just not a favorable position to be in. So the question there then becomes, and using, for example, this latest breakthrough, if we can call it that, by DeepSeek, the Chinese AI company, the question then becomes, to what extent do open sourced systems elevate countries in that middle tier, right? Those countries that would presumably have to choose between the US and its allies and China when it comes to those core critical technology stacks. We're seeing that playing out even as we speak. I'm thinking of cases like the G42 AI company in the United Arab Emirates that was forced to choose between the US and China. This is going to be playing out in places like Malaysia as they build and they invest heavily in data centers, Vietnam, Singapore, you know, places like that. So the question then is, how significant really has that breakthrough been by DeepSeek to elevate an open source system to the point to where it can be a legitimate power multiplier for a middle tier country? And give that country agency. You give it agency that it never had, and that remains to be seen. I personally, based on what I've you know, studied and read, and the people I've spoken to regarding DeepSeek, I think that was achieved with a lot more foreign technology than I think some people would say. And I do think that when we look at things like, again, the most critical technology, which is semiconductors, and I want to be very clear, advanced semiconductors, right? Access to advanced semiconductors is still a game changer. China is still years and years away from achieving that, perhaps even decades. And so as long as that is a factor, then as long as you have a country like the United States, Holland, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, that are part of this exclusive club, that club can be manipulated, right? That club can be essentially weaponized. And that means as long as that situation exists, there will be middle-tier countries that are going to have to choose, unfortunately, when it comes to the critical technology stacks.
Hmm. A final question, Alex. So let's say, I mean, your book, it's scholarly work, so it's not a handbook for a policymaker or you don't write out sort of an action plan. But let's say you are advising a government who is a very open economy, prospered a lot from globalization in the way we have gotten to know it over the last 30 years. They realize that there are now national security, tech security developments, which they need to think very strategically about. So how should they think about these issues? Because I assume some of them are going to say, well, all these tech nationalism, security, the risk is that it's going to reduce my prosperity. I'm not going to be able to grow as fast if I either have to restrict the way I do business with other parts of the world. It may be that I need to plow in a lot of government resources into strategic tech planning, tech investments that I have no idea if it's actually going to lead to anything. So what would you say to them?
Well, I think the first really important measure and first really important action is to acknowledge that we are at a major inflection point. and that we are in an age of geopolitics, and that this a major paradigm shift has occurred. And I say that because I think there's a lot of wishful thinking and a lot of willful denial out there. And I think it's really important to move beyond the purely academic arguments about, you know, why industrial policy won't work, why, again, you know, if free markets are essentially hampered, there will be no success for those looking to reshore or do things like that. That is not a particularly useful approach. I think the useful approach is to really seriously scenario map around the different scenarios that could emerge, right? If we had an escalation of you know, geopolitical violence, if we had, you know, a kinetic war, if, you know, there are all kinds of possibilities out there. We learned a few lessons from the pandemic, of course. So I think it's very important, number one, to acknowledge the paradigm shift, to face it full frontal, and to really sort of map out, you know, what the different scenarios could be. The second is, and I refer to this as sort of a techno-nationalist creative destruction. You know, there, even as old value chains are fragmenting, new value chains need to be created. And that is, that's initially maybe a loss-making venture. Governments have to subsidize certain things. There will be failures, et cetera. But at the end of the day, there are all kinds of lucrative financial opportunities in this reorganization that I refer to. One of them, I think, is really, really important, and that is the traceability and the transparency technologies that are going to have to evolve to be able to manage these risks, right? To be able to manage things like end use and end users of technologies in supply chains, to be able to screen first, second, third tier suppliers, to be able to trace, the reg tech that needs to go into this, to be able to trace all of the really critical inputs of financial flows. I think as we look again to a fragmenting world, the things that are going to develop through fintech, through secure financial transactions, through crypto, through so many different things. Again, we are in this paradoxical cycle where the global economy is rapidly fragmenting, but growth is also increasing through AI and productivity gains and these types of things. So we are in a completely different paradigm now. And the first thing to create a good defense and even an offense is to acknowledge that change and to accept it and to essentially incorporate those externalities that we've been talking about in economic policy, in strategic policy, et cetera.
Mm. Very good. Thank you very much, Alex. I should also say, I mean, we've been talking now mostly with references to technologies that we would associate with computer technology, data technology, but I should also mention that your book goes into many other technologies as well. You're talking about clean tech for climate change, financial services, just to mention a few of them. So the book is actually much richer than we have been able to cover in this conversation now. Let me also end by saying that the book is titled Techno-Nationalism, How It Is Reshaping Trade, Geopolitics, and Society. And it's written by Alex Capri, whom I'm now going to thank you so much for having joined me for this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Frederick. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.